From Utah to West Virginia, Wisconsin to Missouri, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Employee Rights Act of 2025 would offer new protections to American workers. Vincent Vernuccio from the Institute for the American Worker is here with details. President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill has been enacted into law. It preserves tax reductions for American families and small businesses. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Senate maneuvering over President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill might accidentally have killed the filibuster. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains. On July 4, 1781, the United States lost two of its founding fathers. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The proposed Employee Rights Act of 2025 is designed to protect the rights of all workers, from those in labor unions to independent contractors. Vincent Vernuccio is president of the Institute for the American Worker. He is here with details. Vincent, welcome to American Radio Journal. Vinny, before we get into a lot of the specifics of the proposed Employee Rights Act of 2025, can you give us the 50,000-foot overview as to what this legislation is looking to accomplish?
The Employee Rights Act, or the ERA, truly puts the American worker first. It protects their right to a secret ballot. It protects them from harassment. It gives them control over how their money is being spent or if their money is being spent for politics. It lets them champion their own destiny, decide how they want to work, if they want to own a small business as a franchise or work as an independent contractor.
Taking a drill down on this, then, you mentioned independent contractors, and that has been an issue that's popped up in a number of states around the country here, how independent contractors are treated, not only by the state governments, Vinny, but also by the federal government when it comes to the taxation and regulation. Can you talk a little bit about what the challenges are that are facing independent contractors and how this legislation would address those challenges?
Absolutely. And as a former independent contractor myself, I can give you kind of the policy wonk overview, but I can also tell you from personal experience. And let me tell you, working as an independent contractor, it gives you the freedom and flexibility to work with who you want, how you want, when you want, and really control your own working environment. And this is why you see people from all over the country working as independent contractors, whether it's, freelance writers to Uber drivers to other people working on apps, whether it's to work full time for themselves or make a little extra money as a side hustle. So it is a, great way to earn an income. But unfortunately, there's recently a lot of uncertainty with it. We see things like California and their Assembly Bill 5. We see things like the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, where it's a provision very similar to California coming out of Congress. And unfortunately, during the Biden administration, we saw both the National Labor Relations Board and the Department of Labor attacking people's ability to work for themselves. Essentially, what these attacks comprise is saying that, no, unless you meet these really stringent criteria, you're actually an employee and you can't work for yourself, even if you want to. So what the Employee Rights Act does is it has a very common sense test, essentially codifying what the first Trump administration's Department of Labor did, and mirroring another bill in Congress called the Modern Worker Empowerment Act, from Representative Kevin Kiley, that says that essentially you're looking at entrepreneurial opportunity, and if that is there, that is one of the main tests across the government to say, yeah, you're either working for yourself as an independent contractor, as a gig worker, or as an employee.
A number of union contracts in recent years have included DEI, so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion, in their contracts. Would this bill address that in any way? Because what we're seeing is that a lot of DEI provisions have actually resulted in reverse discrimination.
There is a concept in labor law. It's called the duty of fair representation. And essentially what it's doing is it's saying that if a union has a monopoly, and you know that's what unions strive for. They have this thing called exclusive representation, which gives them a monopoly to represent all workers at a work site. There's actually another provision of the ERA that addresses that portion. But unions have this duty of fair representation, and what the ERA says is that, you know, they have to treat all workers under their CBAs equally, and they can't negotiate for DEI or provisions that favor one group over another. So the ERA, once again, is protecting all workers. It's ensuring a level playing field and saying that unions can't negotiate more favorable terms, you know, simply based on some DEI criteria.
What is the so-called joint employer standard here, Vinny? Can you explain that, and how does this legislation address that?
Going back to what we were talking about with independent contracting and the attacks on independent contractors, the attacks on workers championing their own destiny, working how they want. Very similarly, we've seen attacks, especially during the Biden administration, from the National Labor Relations Board, attacking people's ability to own and run a small business, particularly in the franchise industry. What, unfortunately, a move to attack the franchise business model has happened recently is saying that a small mom-and-pop shop, so think like the McDonald's on your street corner, that's not owned by McDonald's corporate, that's owned by a small mom-and-pop shop business. But what these attacks have done is say, well, no, actually the employees of that McDonald's aren't just employed by that mom-and-pop shop business. They're employed by a far-distant corporation, and therefore the far-distant corporation, you know, should be liable and set all these rules and all these other things. And the result would be that the franchise business model that really gives opportunity and the ability for entrepreneurs to open businesses for themselves, it would destroy that thing that has been helping so many, you know, start their own business and small business owners. So what the employee rights have to do is it would say that, okay, we've had this traditional test for who is a joint employer. So are they an employee of the small mom and pop shop business, or is it an employee of the small mom and pop shop business and the corporation? And it would just simply say that we've had this control test where it has to be direct. Essentially, the corporation has to be dictating hours and wages and all that, and it couldn't be left solely up to the small business. And if that's the case, then they're a joint employer. But if they're not, then those employees are working for that direct business. And unfortunately, that concept has been under attack for years. The Employee Rights Act would simply protect the franchise industry and have a more direct control for what's known as joint employment.
The Employee Rights Act of 2025, where does it stand in the legislative process?
Representative Rick Allen from Georgia deserves a lot of credit. He is pro-worker, champion worker freedom. He just introduced it last week, so it is a new bill. It's been introduced in the last couple Congresses, the last several Congresses, actually. But now it is, you know, expanded, it is built out, and Representative Allen is, you know, a true champion for workers. And, you know, we will see where it goes. It does incorporate, you know, several concepts and bill language from other pieces of legislation. So it is truly the most comprehensive pro-worker legislation of this Congress.
Vincent Vernuccio is president of the Institute for the American Worker. And Vinny, tell us a little bit about the Institute and where can folks go if they'd like to read more about the Employee Rights Act of 2025 and other items that you are working on.
So our website is i4aw.org, i4aw.org. And we have, you know, all the latest and greatest on the vast array of federal labor law and legislation and regulations coming out of the Trump administration with details on some of the regulations and stuff that happened in the Biden administration that are slowly being ratcheted back. So we are a pro-worker organization educating to champion the rights of individual workers.
Vincent Vernuccio of the Institute for the American Worker. Vinny, thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's been keeping an eye on President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill for months now as it's made its way through the legislative process. The goal was to get it on his desk by the 4th of July. Scott, did we make it?
We made it, Loman, and what a week it's been. In Washington, D.C., we had political theatrics, and Vice President J.D. Vance ended up casting the tie-breaking vote so that the bill passed 51-50, and then it came over to the House of Representatives. For a long time on Wednesday night, it was kind of unclear on what exactly was going to happen. There were some holdouts on the procedural hurdle known as the rule in the House of Representatives, which must be adopted before you can move along to final passage. There were, I think, about 13 holdouts. President Trump was working the phones into the wee hours and into Thursday morning, and ultimately the Republicans in the House, Senate, led by President Trump and Speaker Mike Johnson, got this bill done, and the bill is signed into law on Independence Day, everything that Donald Trump had been asking for. I think it's really important for the American people to understand a few things about the One Big Beautiful Bill. And number one, it does actually prevent the largest tax increase in American history. Democrats wanted to allow Trump tax cuts from 2017 to totally expire, which would have raised taxes by $4.5 trillion and devastated American families and businesses. But the good news is that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act actually expands upon the 2017 Trump tax cuts, and it makes them permanent. We've got very, very important pro-growth provisions like permanency for full expensing of manufacturing and agriculture and resource extraction, free market pro-growth policies that the Club for Growth has championed as necessary for renewing industrial investment in the United States. And full expensing is basically when a business, whether you're a pass-through entity or a corporation, you could take advantage of it and you can write off all your capital expenditures before you have tax liability. For businesses that are looking to invest and grow, this is a big, big, important immediate write-off in year one rather than depreciation over, you know, a short time period, or even 30 years for structures. So that's a really good pro-growth reform. We also saw school choice make it into this bill. Scholarship granting organizations are organizations that ultimately do it. It sounds like they give scholarships to kids that want to do school choice. And this bill provides for a tax credit to individuals and corporations to those SGOs. We've got a lot of other really big, important things in the bill. We've got a doubling of the exemption for the death tax. We've got no tax on tips, no tax on overtime pay, and no tax on Social Security. Well, that's sort of political rhetoric, the way that it was described, because in a reconciliation bill, you can't actually address the Social Security law. So instead, the Republicans worked with President Trump to fulfill that campaign promise by providing a $6,000 deduction for eligible seniors, and that would be anybody 65 years or older. I think that it's also important to talk about the winding down of the Green New Deal. President Biden in 2022 worked with his Congress to pass the greatest scam in legislative history with a bill called the Inflation Reduction Act. But that's actually a green agenda that costs American taxpayers about $1 trillion. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act ends the Green New Scam by terminating green energy tax subsidies and setting free American energy production with the leasing of oil and gas, and also, you know, really winding down those credits. It's important to have free markets. This doesn't mean that America can't have wind and solar and other emerging technologies. What it means is that the U.S. taxpayer is no longer going to be subsidizing it through the Green New Scam.
The bill also included some provisions to help the president in his efforts to tighten up the southern border, did it not?
Yes, absolutely. And we've obviously seen over the first 6 months of the Trump presidency, border crossings have totally plummeted. And we do have border security in place. But this bill is going to strengthen it by providing additional resources to the southern border and making sure that the wall does get completed. It also provides for the funding to allow for at least 1 million deportations every year. And we know that people were coming over at an alarming rate. Sometimes they would come over legally, and they would be what's known as a visa overstay and stay longer than they were allowed to stay. But that changed, I think, under Joe Biden's presidency when we saw people in the caravans. But there's a lot of reforms here that I think are also very, very good. And ultimately, when you have work requirements and things like food stamps and Medicaid, and when you have tax cuts and you prevent that tax increase and you add in school choice and you add in health savings accounts and you add in a strengthening of the southern border, there's so many good things here that I think are totally going to usher in the golden age of America, not just under President Trump, but for the indefinite future.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is united in the idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. We worked closely with members of Congress and the House of Senate to make sure the One Big Beautiful Bill Act was signed into law. If you want to learn more about the bill or about what the Club for Growth does, visit us at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for keeping track of this for all these many months, and we'll check in with you again next week.
You're welcome.
Did the U.S. Senate maneuvering over President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill have the effect of killing the filibuster? We find out from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
The One Big Beautiful Bill Act is currently moving towards final passage in the House. It could be, by the time you're listening to this, on its way to President Donald Trump's desk, although there's still a bit of uncertainty there, so don't quote us on that. But one of the more interesting, I think, undercovered elements of this bill is something that happened when it was in the Senate a few days ago. It passed the Senate earlier this week, and while it was there, the Senate engaged in some maneuvering that may have accidentally, or perhaps not so accidentally, killed the filibuster and might make it easier for Democrats to pass something like Medicare for All if they ever have a Senate majority again. That's what we'll explain today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Obviously, lots of different parts in the Big Beautiful Bill Act. This is, you know, in theory, this is a tax bill. It's about extending and making permanent the income tax rate changes that were made in 2017. Those were temporary changes that expired this year. And so this bill is the attempt by Congress to extend those lower income tax rates. That's a good thing. And to do a bunch of other stuff with tax policy, too. No tax on tips, big tax break for Social Security payments, things like that that President Donald Trump has prioritized. There's also a lot of spending in the bill. And as a whole, the bill is going to add to the deficit over the next 10 years by somewhere between $3 trillion and $5 trillion, depending on what assumptions you're making about economic growth and so on and so forth. All of that we could obviously talk about for a long time, but I think one of the more interesting things here procedurally that's happened with the bill, and this is a bit wonky, but I think you'll agree with me that this is a fascinating sort of procedural question, is how the bill's passage through the Senate could actually pave the way for Democrats to pass even larger spending packages in the future. Okay, so to understand what happened, I need you to imagine a fictional scenario, or maybe not that fictional. Imagine that you're renting an apartment, and the terms of the lease require that you pay your landlord $2,000 every month. Okay, so now that lease, imagine that it is going to expire at the end of this month. So here you sit at the beginning of July, and you know that that lease expires at the end of July, and you have no lease signed for the month of August. So now you're telling yourself you've got $2,000 extra that you can spend on anything else next month. You can buy a fancy new computer, take a vacation. But of course, if you're a rational person and you plan ahead, you're probably thinking, well, wait a minute, I've got to live somewhere next month too. I've got to live somewhere, maybe not here, but I'll have to sign a new lease that'll probably cost me somewhere around that $2,000. I don't have that full $2,000 to spend because, well, I'm still going to have housing costs next month, even if I don't currently have a lease. Ah, but that's because you haven't discovered the magic of the current policy baseline budget, which is all the rage among Republicans right now, and it's what the Republicans use to try to get this bill through the Senate. So those tax cuts, as I said, are set to expire at the end of this year, the 2017 tax cuts. They are going to expire at the end of the year. But Republicans think they found a way to avoid the budgetary cost of extending them. And that cost is pretty steep, as I already said, somewhere between $3 and $5 trillion, depending on what assumptions you make. But the current policy baseline allows members of Congress to ignore that. Using the current policy baseline, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the Senate version of the tax bill will actually reduce the long-term deficit by a few billion dollars rather than adding to it, which is what it will actually do when you look at it in a more rational way. And that's important because getting anything through the Senate, if you don't have 60 votes, requires something called the reconciliation process. It's basically a loophole that gets you around the filibuster. And that's what Republicans have used to pass this bill, just like they did in 2017 to pass the tax cuts originally. But you can only use the reconciliation process if the bill is revenue neutral. You can't add to the deficit. So gaming the system so that the CBO reads this bill as being more or less revenue neutral is essential to being able to pass this, because if they scored it the correct way, the proper way, it would add trillions to the deficit, and then it wouldn't be able to be passed via the reconciliation process. So this whole thing is a gigantic gimmick that allows the Senate to basically route its way around the filibuster. That's what Republicans have done here. And in doing so, they've opened the door to future budgetary shenanigans where this current policy baseline is used to make every new government program appear less costly than it really is. Here's how, for example, Democrats could use this exact same logic to pass a Medicare for All bill that effectively implements single-payer health care at the federal level. A proposal like that would normally carry a price tag somewhere in the vicinity of $10 trillion over the usual 10-year budget window. That's an amount of spending that would be very, very difficult to get even Democrats to agree to in the Senate. But now, what if you could make that same proposal cost just $1 trillion instead? If you pass a single year Medicare for All bill that would expire after just 1 year, then you can turn around a year later and pass a permanent extension of that same program and evaluate the budget impact on the current policy baseline, and magically, just like that, the extension now costs nothing. And Democrats have been pretty clear that they intend to do exactly this. Sahil Kapoor, a reporter for NBC News, says he's run this scenario past a number of staffers on both sides of the aisle, and they've both admitted that it's a plausible one. Senator Alex Padilla this week put out a statement basically saying, "We will not forget how Republicans got this bill through when we have a majority again." And so the whole thing points to a process that will effectively neuter the filibuster when it comes to spending issues in the future. And a more deliberately opaque budget process that opens the door to more spending and kills the filibuster is a path to less fiscal responsibility and even more borrowing. You can't ignore your rent payments, spend the money on other things, and assume that it will all work out. But that's basically what the Senate has done here. And the cost of this bill will be added to an already towering pile of debt. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out the latest issue of Reason Magazine. It's out right now, and it is our first travel issue. It features 34 places around the world where you can find freedom. One of my favorite issues that we've ever done. You can find that at Reason.com. Those pieces will be rolling out the rest of the month. And of course, catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Independence Day, 1781, was unlike any other in our nation's history. Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I recently had the privilege of being featured in the new film, The American Miracle. The film is a docudrama, that is, a mix of interviews with experts in the American founding and reenactments by actors and actresses. These experts include the likes of Joseph Ellis, Robert George, Jana Novak, and myself. The actors range from Richard Dreyfuss, Pat Boone, and Kevin Sorbo to newcomers Libby Smallbone, Nicole Mullen, and Daniel Shippey. The film is based on the book by the same name. The American Miracle, written by the wonderful Michael Medved. The book and film really resonate with me personally because they cover key moments from the founding that I've long lectured about as a professor at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, such as the inexplicable and seemingly miraculous instances of George Washington's repeated survival. The number of times that George Washington, father of our blessed nation, should have died from arrows, bullets, falling in the freezing Monongahela River, crossing the Delaware, and more, really, do suggest a providential protection. And even if you're not a religious person, there seem to be too many astonishing coincidences. To quote Pope John Paul II, coincidence is what the believer calls providence. There were just so many coincidences heaped upon one another at the time of this nation's extraordinary establishment. I can especially relate to George Washington's experiences because they happened in my native western Pennsylvania. I was born in Pittsburgh and raised in Butler, Pennsylvania. Then there are the scenes dealing with the Declaration of Independence, which of course occurred in Philadelphia, likewise in my home state of Pennsylvania. The film, directed by Tim Mahoney and produced by Ralph Ogstrozy and Douglas Maddox, recreates these scenes beautifully. But there's one scene that's especially fitting for this July 4th. It occurred on July 4th, 1826. America was set to celebrate its jubilee, its 50th anniversary. The thriving young country was abuzz. The citizens of the recently established United States of America were proud of the nation they had sacrificed to establish. All were especially appreciative of the great work of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, the two men behind the Declaration. What especially excited the citizens as July 4th, 1826 approached is that Jefferson and Adams were both still alive. George Washington had long ago passed in 1799, but the 83-year-old Jefferson and 90-year-old Adams were hanging on. Both wanted to live to see the 50th anniversary of their country. Would they make it? Yes, barely. They made it. In fact, Adams' final words that July 4th, 1826 were, "Still, Thomas Jefferson survives." But in truth, Jefferson had died several hours earlier. In those days of super slow communication, Adams could not have known of his friend's earlier passing. Hey, CNN wasn't there. In The American Miracle, these final moments in the lives of Jefferson and Adams are reproduced splendidly. Michael Medved expounds upon the unbelievable mathematical statistical probability of these two fathers of the Declaration and ex-presidents living that long and then dying the same day. In fact, no other president lived to be 90 until Herbert Hoover in 1964. Jefferson and Adams remain the only two presidents to expire on the same day. How about that? The fathers of the Declaration. Their countrymen considered their deaths no coincidence. Numerous voices from Daniel Webster to John Quincy Adams stepped forth to proclaim that God had purposely called the two men home that day. Senator Samuel Smith attributed their mutual deaths to, quote, an all-seeing providence as a mark of approbation of their well-spent lives, unquote. Well, make of that what you will, but personally, you can place me on the side of providence, or to borrow from Thomas Jefferson, the side of nature's God. And if you're looking for something really inspirational this July 4th, check out The American Miracle at theamericanmiracle.com. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KMGZ-FM in Launton, Oklahoma, KSDZ-FM in Gordon, Nebraska, along with KXCR-FM in Florence, Oregon. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.